If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious pot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for the 1,000 blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying but fighting back.
Claude McKay immigrated to Harlem during the era of its renaissance and wrote this sonnet in 1919 in response to the riots and violent suppression of African Americans that took place after World War I. Shotgun was written by Junior Walker and the All-Stars in 1965. It was based on the new dance craze at the time, but I just thought I'd throw it in anyway. We now return to self-respect, self-defense, and self-determination. A conversation with Kathleen Cleaver and Mabel Williams.
But anyway, we went to Canada thinking, well, our family had to split up. And this is one thing about our movement. Once, when we were in the South, we reached out all over the country and all over the world and created friends all over. Robert was a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. And he had traveled around speaking about the way the young boys in the Kissing Case had been treated. So we had friends all over. We had to break up as a family in New York. I didn't see my children again until after I got to Cuba. Two boys, 9 and 11. I didn't see Rob again until I got to Cuba. But we were able to survive through that network of friends that we had created all over and eventually end up in Cuba.
When you left for Cuba, it was what year? It was
1961.
61. Okay. When things were heating up, while you were in Cuba. A lot of stuff happened in the Bay Area. To make a long story short, Huey Newton was on trial for the shooting of an Oakland policeman named John Fry and the wounding of another one. And the very small local group that had been called the Black Panther Party for self-defense was in basically a state of collapse when I got here from California, and I was saying, well, you know, you want to get attention on this case, you should have demonstrations. And we started having demonstrations in front of the courthouse for the leader of the Black Panther Party and getting press. And as the people came out of jail and came back, the party built itself again around this case, around freeing Huey, because we felt this issue of self-defense and the murder that we were subjected to was central to what was going on in the whole country. As far as black people were concerned, we could take it from there, and we were organizing a movement to build a party all around the 10-point platforms, and the 10-point platform and the basic principles of human rights and social justice, but the focus was on that trial. The trial was scheduled to start around the 14th or 15th of April 1968. On April 4th, which a day you all remember, maybe not the actual date, but on April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King was murdered in Memphis, where he had been speaking in support of a strike of the sanitation workers. So once he was murdered on, I think it was a, I don't know what day of the week, April 4th, the whole country changed. There was uprising starting in Memphis, going through the South, going through New York, going through, just 200 cities went up in flames. Washington, D.C. was burning. In the Bay Area, Bobby Seale was actually in hiding because he had been getting threatening notes when he would go to court from the bailiff, say, you come to court, we're going to kill you, nigger. But we didn't know whether it was really the bailiffs or was it somebody else. And so Eldridge had said, well, you should just lay low. Don't go to court till we figure out where they came from. So there was a bench warrant out for him. Well, once King was killed, Charles Gary said, well, we have to, the Bay Area was very tense. I think Charles Gary, the lawyer, got the bench warrant withdrawn, and Bobby Seale and Charles Gary and some other people were going around requesting black communities in the Bay Area not to be destructive, in not killing, don't tear up your own community, don't riot. The Black Panther Party office in Berkeley, the headquarters had been moved across the Oakland line. People were jamming the office asking for guns. They wanted to go out and start shooting. 2 days later, there was an encounter between about 50 Oakland police and 8 Black Panthers in Oakland that ended up in a 90-minute gun battle. I don't think the police knew exactly who they were shooting until it ended, it stopped. And it ended up they were shooting Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Hutton. And Bobby Hutton came out, they were surrendering, he came out with his hands up, and he was shot and killed, you know, just riveted with bullets. His body was riddled with bullets, and Eldridge had been shot in the leg, and he couldn't stand up, so he was trying to come out. And neighbors in that area had seen what was going on, and they said, don't shoot, don't shoot, don't shoot. So he was arrested, taken off to San Quentin. That's all April, weekend of April 6th, the same weekend that King was killed. It's totally sort of preposterous when you think about it, but on June, shortly after he was released on a habeas corpus petition, and in Solano County, they said the parole authorities had not proved that he had violated his parole. They let him out on a bail. I can't remember now whether it was right before. I think it was right before that Robert Kennedy was murdered in Los Angeles. So this country is kind of off the hinges. Nobody knew what was going on. It was insane. It was crazy. Everybody seemed to be frightened, except those people who were too young to know how frightening it was. I was one of them. And me and a lot of the teenagers who were in the Black Panther Party. So Eldridge was ordered to go back to prison. You know, this habeas corpus thing was overturned. He was ordered to turn himself in. And he said he was afraid to go to San Quentin because if he went to San Quentin, he'd be killed. That's where he'd come from. So he wasn't going to go to... In fact, he made a big speech and said, told everybody... Not, he said, I didn't leave anything in San Quentin except half my soul and half my heart, and I'm not going back there. I'm going somewhere else. And he disappeared. He eventually ended up in Cuba. I think on Christmas Day, 1968, he arrived in Cuba. I tried to go to Cuba. I tried to join him. It wasn't easy. In fact, it never happened. I discovered after he left that I was pregnant. I wasn't run out of the country. I discovered I was pregnant. I wanted to be with my husband. And the only way, I mean, he wasn't coming back to the Bay Area. So I tried to go where he was. Now, the difficulty is that, you know, you're pregnant for a certain number of days. It's like a very specific timeline here. And I kept trying to go and trying to go and trying to go, and it wasn't happening. And so I finally just picked up and went to France and called up Richard Wright's widow, Ellen Wright, and said, help me, I want to get to Cuba. And I ended up being told that I should meet Eldridge Cleaver in Algiers. So I went to Algiers and I met him there. And we stayed for 4 years.
And that was 69?
69
that you were there.
And had 2 children.
And so kind of the international connections that you made ended up being really, really important, right? And Mabel, you were talking a little bit about how the friends that you had made allowed you to get out of the country. And I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about kind of the international solidarity that and what it was able to help you do, you know, once you had to leave the country.
When we got to Cuba, Robert wanted to and told everybody his fight was not in Cuba. His fight was in the United States. So he wanted to establish a radio program. He came up with this idea listening to Voice of America and heard all of the good stuff they were talking about. And he said, we should establish a radio program. And so he went, he presented the idea to Fidel Castro. Well, Fidel said, okay, and told some of the people, help Williams, he knows what he's doing, help him to get his radio program. And of course, we got a good political education at the time, too, because there were people who said that the struggle that we were leading and the role that we were playing was going to divide the working class in the United States. So a lot of the people didn't want to see us have a radio program. Or if we had one, they wanted to say what could be said on it. And Robert insisted, well, no. If I'm going to have a radio program, I'll have to make the decision as what to be said on the radio program. So that's, we had a political struggle, but Fidel Castro finally went to Radio Progreso and said, do I have to come down here and put Williams on the radio? He didn't have to come after then. They gave us this radio program, and we had broadcast 3 days a week. We made a tape on Monday, and then it was played Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And Rob did all of his own editorials. People sent us news clippings, newspapers, and I read the news of what was going on in the civil rights struggle in the United States and tried to let other people know what was going on. Well, at that time, the Cold War was really something. As you know, the Russians were trying to win over the minds of people of color all over the world. And they were also struggling against some political line with the Chinese. Well, when those three little girls were blown up in that church in Birmingham, Alabama, Rob sent out telegrams from Cuba to leaders all over the world asking them to speak out against what was happening to our people in the south of the United States. He said then, and he said always, they are under attack. My people are under attack. And the government is planning genocide against us. So we need help. If you speak out and bring attention to what's happening to my people in the United States, maybe they will stop doing what they're doing. Well, there were two leaders who responded. At that point, one was Prince Sihanouk from Cambodia, and he wrote, he said something, well, the world didn't pay too much attention to what he said, but then Mao Zedong issued a statement, and the statement said he called on the people all over the world to speak out and support the black people in the United States who were struggling against racial discrimination. Well, that really set off something. We were denounced by some of our leaders in the United States at that time. Rob was called everything but a child of God. He was a communist, he was a black nationalist, a black fascist, and everything else. But at that point, we began to, we were invited to China. And when we went to China, we were taken all over. Rob and I used to laugh at the fact that we had to go out of the United States to be recognized as American citizens. We were invited to diplomatic functions with Africans and Asians and all kinds of rallies and so forth. And everywhere we went, Rob spoke about what was happening to our people here in the United States. So we were able to build bridges of friendship with people from one end of Africa to the other end of Asia, all over Europe as well.
By the time the Black Panther Party came along, the notion of international solidarity, because the Black Panther Party here in Oakland didn't start until 1966. That was after, I believe, the or maybe around the same time of the OSPAL conference in Havana, which Stokely Carmichael and members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had gone to, and subsequently the Organization for Solidarity of the Peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Just as an aside, OSPAL made these beautiful, beautiful posters, and they always had the initials of the organization and a gun underneath. That was their logo. They had established August 17th as the day of solidarity with African American people. So when we had had people visit Cuba, Mexico, I think Bobby Seale and some other members of the Black Panther Party went to I think it was Montreal, the Hemispheric Conference of Solidarity with the Vietnamese. So there was an international consciousness and dimension and recognition within the Black Panther Party from the time it started. Now, there was also in existence, I don't think many people in Oakland actually understood that, but there had been an existence in the world, in Africa, North Africa, West Africa, Caribbean, Europe, and the United States, networks of solidarity for Black radicals that continued. And when I said I went to Paris and called Ellen Wright, I was plugging into an existing network that someone who was a part of, not a part, someone who was one of the leaders of the committee to defend Eldridge Cleaver told me about. So the other thing is that we have to understand that there were countries that had a sense of solidarity with our struggle. There's COINTELPRO, counterintelligence programs functioning within the United States to interfere with our activities, but there's analogous programs to interfere with our international connections. And so in the case of Eldridge Cleaver, he was told through his intermediaries that when he went to Cuba, he would be able, as he requested, to set up a training base and bring Black Panthers there. And he didn't want to go to Cuba to stay. He wanted to go to Cuba and come back as a guerrilla. When I met him, I mean, you might think this is strange, but I met Eldridge Cleaver at a conference in 1967 in Nashville. It was a SNCC conference. And this, he had just gotten out of San Quentin, and he was talking then. He wanted to go to the mountains. He wanted to do Moncada. I mean, he was just, his idea of revolution, and I think a lot of brothers who were in prison had an idea of revolution that was very physical. It was not a metaphysical idea. It was a very physical idea, and they were going to band together, and they were going to set up base camps, and they were going to fight. So he went to Cuba thinking that he was going to be able to do this, and he discovered that the agreements that were made in New York weren't translated into Havana, and that he was told, you can come here as a private citizen, and you're perfectly welcome, and you can bring your wife, but you have to live here quietly as a private citizen. Someone, the very week that I finally decided I'm tired of waiting on my somebody to tell me I can come to Cuba, I just decided to leave. That same week, someone released the story to Reuters that said Eldridge Cleaver was in Cuba. He was there, but it was secret. So I get off the plane in Paris, and I pick up the newspaper, and there's this front page story, Eldridge Cleaver's hiding in Havana. And I said, okay, how'd this get in the paper? It wasn't supposed to be there. So this is the violation of the agreement that you're supposed to live here privately. So he's told, you can't stay here, you have to leave, but you can come back later. So he leaves, he goes to Algiers, I go to Algiers. It turns out that the Ministry of Information of the Algeria, which is a member of the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, is organizing the first Pan-African Cultural Festival, and it's being hosted in Algiers. So when we get there, we discover that there are people who are looking to send us invitations to come to the first Pan-African Cultural Festival, but it's not until the end of July, and we're there at the beginning of June. So they tell us basically just have to lay low, be quiet, and things worked out. They worked out especially because, not because we had such good contacts, but because Eldridge had been in Cuba and he met in Algiers an English-speaking representative of the ZAPU, Zimbabwe African People's Union, who had also been in Cuba as a student. His name was Charles Chikorima. Charles Chicorema came and said, "Oh, my brother, we're so happy to see you." And then he told him his problem, his situation. He was in an awkward position vis-a-vis the Algerian government and the Cuban government. That awkward position being the Algerian government had no idea that he was there because he came in on a Cuban passport with a Cuban name. And so it was worked out by other Africans, and we found a network within Algiers of Algerians, of Africans who were fighting for their independence from Guinea-Bissau, from Angola, in the ANC. In fact, it was a woman in the ANC delegation, because we said, "Well, where can we go? We're here, but where else can we go in Africa?" She said, "This is it. Coming from America, there is nowhere else you can go, because no other country other than Algeria is willing to stand up to the United States." And so what we were doing was what we thought we had to do to continue. We wanted to maintain our struggle, continue, live there, ask for recognition as a liberation movement. The United States State Department had a document, which I heard about many, many years later, and their document was stating that it was very imperative that the black militants in the United States do not make links with the Arab and African revolutionaries, which is exactly what we spent 3 or 4 years over there doing. So you can imagine the kind of intelligence activity being targeted against us in Algiers.
Yeah. That's great. Thanks.
Mike. I might mention that Charles Chicorema was a student when we went to Cuba and spent many hours with Robert talking about and trying to connect our movement.
There you go. That's solidarity.
You have been listening to Root Work. For more information on this program, you can send an email to rootworker, R-O-O-T-W-O-R-K-R, @yahoo.com.